So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
I think Mr. Perfect's gonna be in Ultimate Warriors corner today.
He will.
No, he's gonna be on the side of Matchman Randy Savage.
This is a
welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and
waiting.
And this is Review Away.
What's your point?
I'm just stating. This is Review Away.
Yeah.
How are you doing? You have brought your MacBook.
Yeah?
You didn't think I'd notice.
No.
You always read your notes off of your phone. This time, what's wrong?
I just didn't think you would pick it up, John.
Wait, I noticed everything.
These details are really not that important. I'm also wearing a watch. I'm wearing shoes today. Yep. I'm wearing a shirt and pants.
Light blue shirt.
You feel the need to say that?
I'm wearing a red t-shirt right now.
Who cares?
I'm giving this is theater of the mind, boy. Now all people right. Have a good visual of what we look like and what is in front of us right now.
I got a MacBook. You know what I do notice is that you're missing a coffee. Where is your coffee? Oh,
it's empty.
It was behind. Yeah, okay, it was
empty.
Behind the computer.
Yeah, it's Starbucks today. We're all out of the good coffee in our workplace.
I thought you hated the coffee here.
Well, compared to what my other options are, that being nothing. We have one of those. It's like all these different coffees, and I always get either the breakfast blend or there's another one that's like medium, and they're all out. And the only ones are like the dark ones. I hate dark coffee.
That's what I like.
Oh,
actually.
It's disgusting. Mm. It's terrible.
I already had my coffee today, and I'm suffering from what do you call that?
Suffering.
No, suffering from like a come down.
Oh, no.
Like a caffeine come down.
Uh-oh.
And I've just got like a caffeine headache right now.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. That combined with the lack of sleep that I've been getting over the past week or so, it's been terrible.
Why? Why have you not been sleeping?
I don't know. Just, late at night, I'm just sitting in bed thinking
yeah.
all the time.
That happens to me. I get insomnia a lot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. How do you fix it?
It's really tough. Sometimes, I don't know. I'm thinking about all the stuff I have to do the next day. And it's like, I can't just turn that off. Can't just force myself to not think
wow.
of anything. I need like a blank slate when I go to sleep.
I can't imagine what it's like to be inside the mind of John Pollock. How many things must be going on at once.
Yeah, it can be busy at times.
I got to book a guest for the MMA report. I got to book a guest for the law. I got to do this. I got to do that.
I've got to observe waitings. Attire.
What percentage would you say of your thoughts late at night consist of combat-related material?
Probably a healthy percentage there because I'm thinking of the next day, which is usually work-related. So,
okay.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Are you thinking of SummerSlam 1992 at night?
Yes. Yes. Wembley Stadium. 80,000 people, eh?
Tons, yeah.
We were eight. Remember, this was one of the pay-per-views. This aired on a Monday night here in the U.S. What a different world it was back then where this was taped on a Saturday night and aired Monday night on pay-per-view.
Saturday and then Monday. Yeah, they wouldn't be able to get away with that today.
Ring of Honor tries because they had a pay-per-view on Saturday, and 48 hours later, it's still not up on their website, even though I've paid for it.
Right, right.
I'm pissed about this.
Yeah, so they're not doing it intentionally. They're just...
I'm reaching my boiling point with ROH.
Ah, very clever.
Yeah.
Who's joining us on this podcast?
Oh, lots of people. Are lots of people joining us or just one?
Lots of people.
Okay, we've got two people then.
Two people.
That's confirmed?
Yes.
You were able to lock down the uncle?
I was.
Okay. We are going to be joined by Harry Smith on the show today to chat about... We're going to ask what a then six-year-old Harry Smith thought of this show. Yes. Can you remember anything from when you were six? I don't remember a thing. 1990. Do you remember 1990?
I really can't recall big moments. But you know what? Considering that he was six, he actually remembered quite a bit.
Yes, it was actually impressive. Though he does have the benefit of tapes.
Yeah.
And YouTube to go back and remember what he saw.
But he remembers at least who he was watching with.
I could never do that. But we are going to endeavor to try and pry this out of Harry's memory from the age of six.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I will stumble upon him working a SummerSlam, which he did not work.
How old is Harry?
Well, if he was six in 1992, that would make him 26 now.
Oh, wow. I didn't know he was younger than us.
Yeah,
very young
just
kid.
A young lad.
Wow.
In addition to that, who are we also going to be joined by, Way?
Bret the Hitman Hart.
What?
Oh, yeah.
You got Bret Hart?
I got him via tape.
Wow. Okay, well, Bret
via
Hart.
Via tape from, I'd say, 2010?
So, two-year tape delay.
Yeah, back when John and I did our documentary on Bret the Hitman Hart with our friend George Barbosa, we asked him about a number of topics, one of which was this match at Wembley Stadium with the British Bulldog, and you'll hear him talk at length about it.
Yes, obviously a very famous match in WWF history and in Bret Hart's past as well, so we will chat with both about that. Two generations of the Hart family reminiscing on the Wembley Stadium event.
Appropriate that we chose this show approaching the 20th anniversary of this.
Yeah, I didn't even put those that stat together in my head that it was 20 years ago of that SummerSlam from London, England.
And also recently passing the 10th anniversary of Davey Boy's passing.
So. That is true. He passed away May of 2002. Mm-hmm. So we will chat about that. And you uncovered quite the gem, a 1999 Stampede Wrestling clip involving Harry, Davey, and Mauro Ranallo.
Well, I was watching this show via...
a pay-per-view
means.
That you had purchased back in 1992 and saved the tape.
And under the related links, it just showed this rare interview where Davey Boy introduces Harry Smith, and I click on it. And the person who is introducing me to this clip is our good friend and former colleague, Mauro Ranallo, a very young Mauro Ranallo from, of course, Strikeforce and Pride Fighting Championships. At the time, Mauro was the commentator for Stampede Wrestling.
And, along with Bad News Allen.
Right, and conducting this interview with the then very young Harry Smith and a Davey Boy Smith that had just returned to the WWE.
I was looking at the related videos as well to Stampede Wrestling, looking at the Stampede Wrestling clips from 1999, and that's when like Johnny Devine worked there. And
oh, wow.
They always joked about how Bruce would just come up with these ridiculous names, like, oh, what was it, like, Dirty Dick something. There was Sodom Insane. Like, all these just, like, pun names, which... Yeah. I will come up with as jokes, but would feel bad about bestowing upon a guy as his wrestling gimmick for my own amusement.
Maybe like a Mike Jong Il or something.
Mike Jong Il. Yeah. There's a whole new generation of terrorism that Bruce could have used for wrestling heels.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, never say never. Maybe a revival will come at some point.
I think so. You got Teddy on board.
Oh, Teddy. Yeah. I would totally watch weekly television that Teddy booked every week.
Oh,
can you imagine what that would be like?
I can. I can. Jumping boots and cats.
Cats and, high spots.
I totally watch that.
We need to have Teddy back on some week.
I'd love to.
It would be fun. No excuse. We could just call up Teddy and just chat.
Yeah.
Say, what's going on, Teddy? And that'll be the start.
Mm-hmm.
Just go from there. Well, let's chat about SummerSlam. As we mentioned, from Wembley Stadium in London, England, the only SummerSlam to air outside of the North American continent, and one of the few tape-delayed pay-per-views in company history, something that, you could do this in 92, but it's something that it's definitely tougher logistically to do today, just with stuff spreading so fast. And you would basically have to do this show at like, you would want to keep that North American time slot of like 8 Eastern. So you're talking about like 1 a.m. Start time in England if you want to do that.
We've seen the UFC try to do this with their pay-per-views in Japan and in Australia. I forget when they used to do the shows over in the UK. Did they start and then
they used to do it where you could like order it live on pay-per-view or watch it for free on Spike.
They would do it in the afternoon. They would do it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, they kind of changed it up sometimes. But yeah, other times they would make the pay-per-view available in the afternoon, and they never were as strong as the North American pay-per-views just because of the watching it in the afternoon, taking people out of their habit. And it's something that, I mean, it's a huge fan base they have over in the UK, but just so tough to pull off logistically. We talked about when TNA taped over there earlier this year, how great the crowds were of maybe doing a pay-per-view there eventually. But unfortunately, the time zone.
Maybe they could get everybody to sign waivers saying you cannot release the results. Like, you know, on reality shows, when they finish taping a reality show, they get people to sign, or else we'll sue you for $1 million. You could do that.
Yeah, that seems possible.
Yeah, 80,000 people.
Or maybe you could just institute a universal time zone where it's always the same time for everybody.
How can that work?
It's just you'd have to configure the sun and its rotation. But once you got that down...
How would you find
it? Well, maybe you just change people's habits. Like, you know, afternoon, it's dark. And then it's light out at 3 in the morning.
Who are the people that get fucked? Because it would probably be...
Well, the Asians would, you know, they are 13 hours ahead of us. So
then you're saying the people in China should...
You just got to change your habits. Like, what would... Well, imagine, like, if they slept during our day, which would be their night... And then they'd be awake when it's dark out. It's just changing habits,
oh, yeah,
you know?
That's great.
Why?
Why would they get that?
I would try it out.
Why would the Asians be the ones to give in, to become nocturnal? Why wouldn't it be people here?
Well, where the U.S. goes, I feel the world would have to adjust to.
Really?
Eastern time zone would have to be the time zone of choice, I would say.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be a weird... test if you could, like, you'd have to live a day where you wake up at, you know, when do you usually wake? You're a weird case.
Actually, I would work out fine.
You would love this. But like, okay, I wake up at like 8:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. So let's shift it. I would wake up at 8:30 p.m. at night and go to work for like 9 p.m. and I would work till like 6 a.m. Come home. And then I'd go to sleep around noon.
A lot of people do this. A lot of people work night jobs.
It's like overnights, but you just flip it. And then everyone would have, you know what? It makes no sense at all.
Yeah, you're just...
Because your pay-per-view would be starting... This is all for wrestling pay-per-views so that they could do them somewhere else. Like, you'd be sleeping when you'd be trying to accommodate everyone. You'd be sleeping at like... Or you would wake up and the first thing you do is watch a pay-per-view. So that...
What are you talking about?
Never mind. I don't know. I don't know what's in this coffee. What a stupid idea. There's a reason for time zones.
What a waste of time.
Nah, it's just interesting to think about.
Okay.
I like to get chatter started amongst our message boarders.
You like to get people to insult us about how stupid our ideas are.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, well, it's good.
I like people to take our just ridiculous hypotheticals and then add like graphs to them and logic.
Right, right. Well, it's what we do on a daily basis.
It's fair play.
We take other people's stupid ideas and
it's like you're flipping time zones. It's on them now.
Yeah.
To play us.
Yeah.
Let's get into SummerSlam.
80,355. Is that a legit number?
I think that's the legit number. Yeah, I think that's the legit number.
Why wouldn't they try to inflate that?
They could have, but maybe they... It's so weird. This is the legitimate highest paid attendance they've ever had in company history.
More so than WrestleMania 3.
Yes, WrestleMania 3. It's a long story, but the legit like event... like the event sheet that Zayn Breslov... produced. He was the event promoter for that WrestleMania 3 event. He produced this document, and it was his event he was promoting. I mean, he has no reason really to lie. Confirmed it was like 78,000 at the Pontiac Silverdome, and then this show actually had a higher paid attendance, but because of WWF folklore, they couldn't announce this was the biggest show in history because of that 93,000 number. So maybe it was just why inflate it when it's not going to be a record for us anyway. I don't know.
I see.
But some incredible.
Some weird thinking.
It's amazing, when you think about it, that 78,000 at the Pontiac Silverdome, they're like, it's just not impressive enough.
Yeah.
And I wonder how they just randomly came up with like the most famous attendance figure of all time. That it's so funny because you tell people this fact that's backed up by fact, and it's like you're telling them Santa Claus is not real. I've had people like email me just angry. What happened was, I was out once with some friends years and years ago, and somehow this came up about 93,000, and I was telling them that's not the legit figure. And this one guy who just never wanted to be wrong ever, and I never wanted him to be right, so we collided a lot, got into this argument, and I was just like, it's just not the true number. And he's like, no, it is.
Did this guy know what you did for a living?
I didn't do this for a living at the time. Oh, okay. I was just a fan, but someone that I think was, you know, a more informed fan than him, who was like, the WWF would not lie. Like, you're such a fool. Anyway,
he's on steroids.
But I remember he was like, well, you have no proof. And I went home. I was like 16, 17, and I emailed Dave Meltzer. And I was like,
wow,
Dave, I've always heard you talk about this story about 78,000 people. And what's the whole genesis of this number? Because I've heard you talk about it and that Zane Bresloff would confirm this number. And he sent me, this was like, I think the first time I ever emailed Dave Meltzer. And it's like, fuck, how many emails must Dave Meltzer get from people? Like, numerous, I would assume. Mm-hmm. He sent me back like this huge letter running down the whole attendance figure.
Was this email or?
This was email. I still have the email, actually.
Okay. Wow.
It's in my old Hotmail
account.
You should
post it.
Maybe. Oh, it's a private email. Actually, I probably should.
You're really revealing it, man.
It's got the fact to it. Anyway, you want me to pull it up?
Yes.
All right. You got to talk for a second.
Wow. Okay. John is actually, well, this is the privilege of having the internet and having everything be permanent on the internet is that at a moment's notice, John can pull up an email from his, from how long ago? 11 years ago, when John was just a young 17-year-old, no idea what he was going to do for a living. His first correspondence with somebody he talks to on a weekly basis now, Dave Meltzer. How are you actually even going to go about finding this? They might even just delete it, you know, for all you know.
No, I think it's in here somewhere.
Okay.
Let's see.
Well, John, as you're looking for this, I feel like we're finding a part of your past here. We're finding out what a 17-year-old John Pollock used to type like.
Found it.
You did. Holy shit, that's huge.
Yeah, this is long, dude. I don't know if I can read this
whole
thing. That's
massive.
Do you want me to try and get through it? Or should I skim through?
Skim through it. Just give us the first tidbit.
The building settlement.
What was your question? What was your query?
That part's not in this.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Dave Meltzer's response to a young John Pollock's question about the
WrestleMania 3 attendance. All right. I just know that the building settlement had the figure at 78,127 people and just over $1,599,000. Zane Bresloff, who promoted the event, has publicly confirmed those figures to anyone who asked, including on Mike Tenay's radio show years ago, and he and Hogan were best friends, so it's not like there was an ulterior motive for a promoter of an event to say, look at the attendance figure of the show I promoted. It was really lower. If anything, he would lie to say the 93,000 figure is correct. He has the original source saying the place held a little over 80,000 legit, and some seats were blocked off for cameras. When he called to say that people have been saying 93,000 for so long, they are starting to believe their own lies. And let's... Later, I saw the building settlement that confirmed that number. Basil DeVito, who worked for the WWE at the time, came up with 93,173 to beat an 88,000 number they used for the Pope in that building, not D'Angelo De Niro, which also may have been worked, but there were no seats blocked off and far more standing on the floor than ringside seats.
Hmm.
Where was there was also one thing here.
Oh, so that makes sense that they would want to beat the Pope.
Yeah, so there you go, and then there you go. So it's a very long.
And the Pope wouldn't lie.
Yeah, that's kind of, it's one thing for a wrestling company to lie, but for the Pope to lie about his drawing power.
Yeah,
that's a little weird, isn't it?
That's like God lying about his drawing power.
Yeah. Anyway,
I don't see that happening.
So SummerSlam is the highest paid attendance in WWF history.
Okay.
We don't screw around with facts on this show, we.
No, that's great.
We like to fact check. How many sittings did it take for you to watch this, we?
How many sittings? I don't know how you would split that up, but I mean, I saved this till the last day. I watched it all last night, and I thoroughly actually enjoyed the show. I split it up because I had to move around the house, but I sat through and I didn't fall asleep or anything. I quite enjoyed this show.
Mr. Ting did not partake in any viewing?
No, this was late at night.
Oh. Well, the show starts off with a bunch of footage from around the area of all these fans around the UK, a lot of them dressed up in their favorite wrestlers' costumes. The highlight being this one little, like, 7-year-old telling the camera, "British Bulldog is going to win, whether he wants to or not."
Huh. There you go. Well,
whether he wants to or not, well, he's going to win.
He understands booking.
They show Buckingham Palace, trumpets, horses, carriages. This was quite the opening here to England.
This reminded me of the Olympic ceremonies that we just watched.
Minus the Spice Girls.
Yeah.
And BDI.
BDI.
With Liam Gallagher.
Uh-huh.
The world, I think, discovered who BDI was this past weekend. I don't think anyone had heard of this group.
I saw a funny tweet saying, "This new BDI song is really great."
I heard
they're playing Wonderwall.
Yeah, someone called it the band. It's like FAUX, Foasis. What is Noel Gallagher up to these days? Does he do anything?
I don't know. Actually, I did some research afterwards, and the two of them apparently had beef over something, as always. But like it got.
Were they both like real hotheads, or was it more just Noel Gallagher who was the nut?
No, they both were.
Oh.
I think they were both notorious, but since Noel left, there's some litigation between the two.
Oh, that's horrible.
But I think recently they patched things up because this Manchester soccer team recently won a championship, and that kind of, now they're friendly texting each other.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's weird that we even know that.
Yeah.
Their lives are just, I mean, it, you know, we think TMZ is crazy. Over in the UK, paparazzi is a whole different animal.
Can you imagine if you were like that kind of a figure where it's like if you just posted some joke on Twitter, like websites would pick it up?
Yeah.
Like look how many, someone tweets and it's like it's a news story on a wrestling site.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
I can't imagine that. I don't want to. That would suck.
Could you imagine, Wei, if you tweeted your support of someone running for Senate and then you were fired, like Abraham Washington?
What was his tweet?
Last week he tweeted, "The primetime players fully endorse Linda McMahon."
He wasn't fired for that.
I think that was a contributing factor, was his tweets.
What was wrong with that?
I think they didn't want this guy tweeting about Linda McMahon. Oh. I think they're very cautious in terms of any of their talent talking about Linda.
That wasn't the only tweet that he sent.
No, apparently, I didn't see this one, but Dave brought up on Sunday, he tweeted, "Where's Rosa Mendez?"
Yeah, yeah.
Like, just bad judgment. I understand the whole, like, people are arguing freedom of speech, but you know what? When you're working for a company, you're not going to jail for what you're saying. But a company, they can hire and fire as they please.
Right. The argument is that, you know, somebody like Vince could go on and make fun of JR's Bell's palsy, or he could say the N-word and nothing would happen to him.
Of course.
But a guy like Abraham Washington couldn't say something as, I'm not going to say...
If he was scripted to do those things, he would be allowed to do it. It's not like Vince just ad-libbed the N-word into a backstage segment.
No, he didn't. No, but anyway, I feel like that argument's played out. It's done. He's fired, as we expected.
Yep.
Don't do it.
Maybe
again.
He'll be back.
He could. I don't see the upside to him, though. I really don't. I was never really a fan.
Maybe he'll show up in TNA.
Maybe. I'd like to see his stand-up.
I would too.
He's promising a lot of Vince jokes, and I can't wait for that.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. It's a tough...
Him and Foley can do a show.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Stand-up's, it's tough. I don't know if he's ever done stand-up before. He's just going in cold. I mean, it's a tough way to entertain.
He could do it.
Well, we'll see. SummerSlam began with, we went through the footage. And our announcers tonight, Vince McMahon and Bobby the Brain Heenan, who had a Jerry the King Lawler crown before Jerry Lawler debuted with the company.
He was wearing a crown, yes, because he was in England and called himself the King.
Yep. And we kick things off with Money Incorporated, accompanied by Jimmy Hart, taking on Legion of Doom, who had two people in their corner, Paul Ellering and Rocco.
What is the deal with this? What was Rocco?
This was the WWF's idea to, market them better, because the Road Warriors were so unmarketable before when they came in that they gave them these guys need a ventriloquist dummy named Rocco. And Hawk was so mad about this fucking thing that he almost quit over it. And in fact, this was his last match with the company before he would leave, because after this show, him and the Berserker, they decided to just disappear, and they didn't go on the trip back home with the company, and he just left the company and kind of fucked Animal too, because Animal didn't want to quit, but they're kind of a package deal.
Now, what happened with Hawk before this? Wasn't he suspended recently for a drug violation?
He had been. He was suspended for it was for drugs. I don't believe it was steroids, as some had thought, but it was supposed to be kept really quiet. And then Penthouse did an article on the WWF, and somehow it was revealed that Hawk had been suspended for a drug suspension, and he was pissed. So the two sides were not getting along at this time, and I guess this was kind of the breaking point for Hawk between a drug suspension and Rocco.
Yes. Wow, that's quite the.
I respect someone who at least stands up to something like a puppet and says, "No, fuck this, I'll leave." Could you ever imagine someone today doing that? Like Finley quitting over Hornswoggle being added to his act.
It's a lot harder to find work these days. I mean,
oh, I know. It's a different world.
Yeah. This was also slated to be a title match originally when it was first promoted, when Money Inc. kept the championships, but they recently dropped the belts to the Natural Disasters.
Yes. I don't know what the circumstance was behind that. But anyway, yes, the Natural Disasters were the tag team champions, because thankfully we were able to get a Natural Disasters match on this card as well.
Oh, come on. The first thing I notice about this show is just the impressive looking crowd. I mean, at 80,000
it was spectacular.
Plus. And the WWE has always, even dating back to 20 years ago, done a great job of capturing the size of its audience on its television. I mean, you compare this to, you know, like a UFC at UFC 129 at the Rogers Center, which really looked no different than any other UFC show. So the WWF always doing a great job completely, you know, changing the atmosphere of their show.
Before we get into this match, there were three dark matches way before that we missed out on.
Oh, no.
We had Jim Duggan and the Bushwhackers defeat the Mountie and the Nasty Boys. Papa Shango defeated Tito Santana. And Tatanka defeated the Berserker.
Well, thank you for that.
Just wanted to update everybody in case they're curious.
Did you ever hear the story that this was originally slated to take place in Washington, this show?
No, I didn't.
In Dave Meltzer's tribute for the Bulldogs entry, he lists that HBK was originally supposed to be in his role when this show used to be in was supposed to be in Washington.
And it would have been Brett and Sean?
Yeah.
Oh, that is interesting. I had not heard that story. And eventually the title would get on to Sean. But Bulldog here, this was probably, would you say, the most high-profile match of his career?
I would say so. Yeah.
I mean, here he is, the home country hero, coming in to main event the show. And this one was really interesting, Way, because the way they marketed this was, at the time, watching this, like, I just watch Superstars every week. I mean, yes, they pushed Bret and Bulldog, but Warrior Savage was promoted as the main event, whereas over in the UK, it was Bret and Bulldog that was pushed as the main event. Hmm. So it was almost like you were promoting two different main events different audiences. Kind of like what you probably would have seen if Roy McDonald and BJ Penn had fought here in Toronto. You would have really wanted to push that fight to your Canadian audience, whereas in the US, maybe Stan Bisping would have been higher priority to them, mm-hmm. along with the flyweights.
They've never really done that, though. And I don't know if they would have. I mean, I feel like BJ versus Rory would be a bigger deal anywhere than Stan versus
perhaps.
Bisping.
We go into the match, and IRS cuts a promo on the British not paying their taxes and putting the burden on the royal family for instant heat. The air horns in this crowd way were something else.
It's a soccer thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Football,
soccer. It's all the same thing. Mm-hmm. DiBiase gets clotheslined to the floor by Hawk and then gets clotheslined by Animal on the floor, and IRS gets in, applies a sleeper to Hawk, escapes, tries for a clothesline off the top, and Hawk, like, wipes out here, missing this clothesline off the top and goes to the floor, gets slammed by DiBiase, and then Hawk is back in the ring, gets worn down. Hawk just seemed like messed up here after the spot where he wiped out, which actually helped his selling, which has not always been the Road Warriors' strong point. Hawk gets choked with a tag rope. Lots of choking here with items.
Which was okay back then.
It was okay in 92 yeah. to choke people with ropes and whatever.
Do they not do that spot today? The tag rope choking anymore?
No, you never see that. Huh. You don't see choking with anything, really. Finally, he makes the hot tag to Animal, comes in, hits a double clothesline to Money Inc. All four are in the ring at this point, and IRS gets sent to the floor. They attempt to go for the Doomsday device, but Jimmy Hart distracts the referee, and IRS drop kicks Animal with DiBiase on his shoulders. They throw IRS out, and this time Animal hits a power slam to DiBiase for the win at 12 minutes here. So another tag team way, week two in a row, where the heels were not taking the Doomsday device from the LOD. A move that I don't think anyone would want to take. And Legion of Doom get the babyface win here.
A very formulaic match, I thought. Although it didn't feel too slow, and I attribute that to the novelty of the setting.
I agree. I think the crowd certainly helped a lot of these matches on the undercard. Mm-hmm. And Gene Okerlund is in the back then with Ric Flair. There were about 5,000 backstage interviews on this show between Gene Okerlund and our favorite Sean Mooney.
That was sort of the template of the shows at the time. They were just, instead of video packages, you would go to these interviews.
You had guys who could cut promos. Yeah. Cut promos. Mm-hmm. So Okerlund is with Flair and complains about not getting the WWF title rematch against Savage tonight. And the storyline going into this was that Mr. Perfect would be in either Randy Savage or Ultimate Warrior's corner, and you'd tune in to find out which corner he would be in. And Okerlund says that he's trying to pry it out of Perfect, and Perfect says, "I'm going to be in the corner of the winner." Subtle. Mm. Then we went to a fantastic promo from Sean Mooney with Virgil, who was boxing away, getting ready for his match, and he cuts a promo and ends it by saying, "I am definitely too legit to quit." And did this crazy hand sign for all these, like the acronyms here. I love Virgil. Just loved him.
Do you? I don't know.
Too legit to quit.
You loved him perhaps for all the wrong reasons.
Maybe. I was more impressed with Sean Mooney that he could get an interview with Virgil.
Mm, yes, that's right.
Not the easiest task. We got Nails. Remember Nails?
Mm-hmm.
This match was significant because when Nails would later accused Vince McMahon of, making an advance at him after this match. It was something over the payoff or something like this, and then Nails tried to accuse Vince of trying to touch him or something. It was really weird. Anyway, Nails didn't last long after this. And taking on Virgil here, Nails didn't even get an entrance. What a character.
Actually,
Nails with a Z.
Yeah, a lot of guys didn't get entrances here.
Well, time did not permit, nor did you really need one for Nails. It was just him walking down, even that music.
It's a giant aisle here.
It was a long one, yeah. So Nails, who was this big heel they were pushing at the time for an eventual match with Big Boss Man, his backstory was that he was imprisoned by the Big Boss Man, and he was going to seek revenge.
He was mistreated in the prison.
Yeah, and it led to a really memorable angle on TV where Big Boss Man won a squash match, and then Nails made his debut and beat the fuck out of Big Boss Man with a nightstick. And then in WWF Magazine, they showed all the pictures of Big Boss Man, all bruised and iced, and he looked like a wreck. And everyone wanted to see Big Boss Man get his revenge on Nails, who cut the most screeching promos you've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Match begins. Virgil got a few spots here with a drop kick and a roll up, but Nail starts choking him, tosses him to the floor. Virgil got his feet up as Nail runs into the corner, but then he knocks Virgil down and chokes him with like a standing arm triangle here, and they call for the bell at 3 minutes and 17 seconds and attacks Virgil with the nightstick after the match. So not a good night for Virgil.
No, there wasn't much to this. Some pretty basic kind of crappy wrestling takes place here. It just seems to be a backdrop for the Boss Man match.
Then we got my favorite personality on the whole show, Lord Alfred Hayes, who was the investigative journalist and took the first word of that title as seriously as possible.
What great journalism. Oh, Lord Alfred Hayes.
This was so great.
What does he do?
I am investigating the whereabouts of Macho Man, and I cannot confirm that I do a terrible Lord Alfred Hayes.
Oh, this is good.
But,
it sounds a lot like your Rob Scott impression.
I guess. Yeah. That's South African.
He's South African, but it's all the same thing.
He cannot confirm that Mr. Perfect is in the locker room of the Macho Man, but he can confirm to us, Way, that the door is locked.
He basically just stands here, and his research consists of knocking and banging on locked doors.
It's on par with when you go to the bathroom and the door is locked. That is his research. Then we go to Okerlund with Sensational Sherry wearing a very non-PG outfit and talks about how Shawn Michaels attacked Bret Hart, leading to Rick Martel beating Bret by DQ but not winning the Intercontinental title. And then Rick Martel started hitting on Sherry and winked at her. She winked back and says that both men are attractive and she is going to stand by her man. So more cryptic messages of whose corner she's in.
She's also negotiated a stipulation stating that both men cannot hit each other in the face. Because they're
what a stupid stipulation
so
here.
Looking. Oh, it was funny, I thought. Good
so we heat. Had two heels with a heel having to pick who she would align with, and you could not hit them in the face.
Yeah.
So maybe on paper this sounded interesting. Rick Martel is in the ring wearing tennis gear. Mm. I always loved Rick Martel. Mm. I thought he was fantastic. And Shawn Michaels comes out to the Sherry version of Shawn Michaels' theme music, and she's holding a giant mirror. And McMahon notes that, uh-oh, part of Sherry's outfit is missing, as we see her in, like, these ass chaps wearing a thong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
That's exactly it.
You couldn't wear that today in the WWE if you're a woman.
No, probably not.
Anyway.
They come close, though.
Yeah, we don't really see thongs anymore.
No, not so much.
No. Rick Martel against Shawn Michaels. Martel starts doing jumping jacks and misses a cross body out of the corner to Shawn. Michaels gets tossed over the top to the floor, and they play up the agreement that they will not hit each other in the face. And Martel takes Sherry away from Shawn as he's tending to Shawn, and Martel hugs Sherry. And they come back into the ring, bunch of roll-ups, holding the tights, and McMahon, as Shawn's tights get pulled down, we see his ass crack, and Vince just couldn't help with the puns. Talk about cheek to cheek. There's a full moon out in England.
A lot of these in this match, not just with Shawn. But you know what? Shawn used to do a lot of these spots. These
this is a flare spot.
Yeah, these tights pulling.
Easy shots. Heat, I guess.
I suppose so.
At one point, Vince totally set up Heenan saying, "Is that Jupiter?" When we were staring at Shawn's ass.
Yes, yes.
Very clever. Michaels here, he hit the sweet chin music before it was known as such. Here it was simply called a two count.
Mm-hmm.
And Michaels pins him using the ropes, but Joey Morella catches him. And Martel then uses a schoolboy for a two. And this is where they start coming to blows here, and they shove each other. Michael slaps him. Martel slaps him back. And Sherry is freaking out and gets on the apron. And she faints. She just faints here, worrying about the two punching each other, and they both tend to her, and they start fighting on the floor by the entrance, and they get counted out at 8 minutes and 7 seconds as Sherry then sits up and then goes back to playing dead. And this went back and forth here with Michaels then coming back to help her, and he's carrying her to the back. And this is when McMahon made the Jupiter joke and then made a Twin Peaks reference. And Martel returns, attacks Shawn Michaels as he dumps Sherry onto the floor. Then Rick carries Sherry to the back, and Martel gets hit from behind. Sherry took more bumps in this post-match than the other two did during the actual match. And Martel then brings out a bucket of water as Sherry's being held to the back by Michaels and dumps it onto Sherry to revive her. And Michaels chases after Martel, leaving Sherry on the entranceway drenched.
They're basically tossing Sherry around. It was like a Three Stooges gag where one was trying to help the other, but in the process they were just injuring Sherry even more. In terms of a wrestling match, this didn't last very long, but what did occur was very good, I thought. I thought Martel and Sean were both working really good, really good fast pace, and I would have liked to have seen these two guys actually come to a finish. Unfortunately, the Sherry stuff kind of got in the way, although I found it slightly entertaining as well.
I thought Sherry was the best part of this match. I wasn't too much into the match between the two. Sean Mooney is then with the Nasty Boys and Jimmy Hart laughing about Sherry. It was weird. They had Jerry Sags cut this weird promo on Randy Savage and Ultimate Warrior demanding a title shot, and then they, like, transitioned over discussing the tag titles. I didn't understand what they were talking about in terms of the WWE title. And they ask Jimmy if they're getting the next tag title shot, and at this point, Jimmy Hart was managing both the Nasty Boys and Money Incorporated, and Jimmy got all nervous and hesitated and said, "Of course you'll get the next title shot." So this was going to lead to some dissension where Jimmy Hart would have to pick one team over the other.
Yeah, eventually this led to the Nasty Boys turning babyface.
Yes. So we go to the Natural Disasters against the Beverly Brothers, Bo and Blake, with the Genius. With the tag titles on the line, the Genius cuts a promo discussing the Olympics and the World Cup in England, and the Beverly Brothers go after Earthquake and Typhoon at the bell and lay them out with clotheslines and splashes the Beverly Brothers as McMahon says after a splash, "Talk about the Earl of Sandwich."
Hmm?
No, that's what he said. Blake tries to scoop slam Typhoon, but Typhoon lands on top of him. Earthquake misses Blake and splashes Typhoon in the corner as the Beverlys get the heat. Bo leapfrogs over Blake, lands on the back of Typhoon. The body of this match was just extremely boring.
Very slow.
Yeah, very, very slow. Bo distracts Earthquake for a tag as Blake then gets the metal scroll and attacks Typhoon with it, but Earthquake then drops an elbow onto Blake in the ring and Typhoon makes the hot tag. Earthquake comes in with a hip toss and a belly-to-belly suplex to Bo, double shoulder block, and then sends Blake to the floor, splashes Bo and knocks Blake off the apron, jumps and sits onto Blake for the win. The crowd at least got into the finish here, but the majority of the match, and this one went 10 minutes and 24 seconds, was not too entertaining. And afterwards, when they retained the titles, they then attacked the Genius.
Mm-hmm, mm. The crowd loved the Earthquake splash.
They were into it. They liked fat people jumping on small men.
I thought they were a good team, I always thought. They were, I mean, in-ring you could say what you want, but
I liked their promos because they were always out of breath and always yelling.
Sure, and just the visual of these two guys, these two sumo wrestler type of guys, I think it's great. Imagine if this team were in the WWF today. They'd totally stand out, and it'd be very different.
They'd be told to cut their hair and lose weight, and they'd just be the Naturals.
Sure.
They'd be Dennis Quake and Ty.
What?
They'd be given real names. They wouldn't be given Earthquake and Typhoon.
Why Dennis?
I don't know. I'm just picking a name. They just pick random names.
Okay.
Michael McGillicuddy.
Yeah.
They would be like, who knows? Fred Boat. All right. Oakland is with the Bushwhackers, who are having fun here. Discuss whose corner Mr. Perfect will be in, because everyone wants to know where the Bushwhackers fall. And they ask Luke if a dentist here is trying to sell him a London Bridge. This is where I see how puns can be really annoying. The royal family has invited them to dinner at Buckingham Palace, and they will sit on the royal throne. Why did we have to hear from the Bushwhackers?
Because
we flew them over here?
I suppose so. I had no idea what they were talking about, but you know, it was nice to see their delivery. It's just nice sometimes when we look back on these shows to see these guys have a cohesive look and a cohesive style of promo.
Lord Alfred Hayes is continuing his investigation, and he is outside the Ultimate Warrior's locker room. and he's whispering his update.
My exhaustive search to locate the whereabouts of Mr. Perfect has come to an end. I have reason to believe that Mr. Perfect is inside the Ultimate Warrior's dressing room. Now, I'm going to breach my own code of ethics. I'm not going to knock on the door. I'm just going to open it and surprise them. Well, I must say, now that doesn't necessarily mean that Mr. Perfect is inside that dressing room, but it certainly was a shocking and vulgar act of rudeness. And now back to the ringside.
This is great. He says he is going to breach his own code of ethics by not knocking on the door. I am going to surprise them and walk in. And he opens the door, and the door gets shoved closed in Alfred's face. And Alfred says, "My word, certainly was a shocking and vulgar act of rudeness." Alfred Hayes was just
awesome.
This guy
was about to sneak in without knocking.
What if...
Talk about rudeness.
You know, a few months later, the Ultimate Warrior was fired because he was getting mysterious shipments of steroids. Do you know what Lord Alfred Hayes could have walked in on?
No. Yeah.
Good thing that Ultimate Warrior learned to lock his locker room door.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I thought Alfred Hayes was just phenomenal. Just phenomenal.
He was funny.
I guess Wade didn't appreciate his British charm as much.
No, I appreciated it. Just, yeah.
Then we went to, to some people, the real main event of the show. The Battle of Demolition.
That's right.
Smash and Crush, better known as Repo Man at this time, against Kona Crush.
Mm-hmm.
Crush had just the greatest spandex outfit I think I've ever seen. Every color imaginable here. He had orange, he had purple, he had a goofy logo where it's the words crush in like a bubble that's getting squeezed and crushed.
Like Skittles.
Yeah, like Skittles.
But like the tropical Skittles.
Yeah, yeah. He was his whole outfit was tasting the rainbow. And the match begins. Crush military press slams him up and then clotheslines him onto the floor, kicks the ribs, backbreaker. Repo Man stops Crush and sneaks up from behind and hits him with a back suplex. Even, like, just the way he would, like, stalk him before. He was very much a Repo Man here.
Sure.
And Crush...
Repo Men stalk people?
They have to be quiet and unassuming when they're about to take your car. Crush gets up. He then goes to the top rope and misses a knee drop and just gingerly gets up. Like, I missed. No sells Repo Man's offense. Repo Man comes off the top, and Crush catches and power slams him, and then his finish. Wait, can you describe his finishing maneuver?
Well, this
was back. This was like A and select in Sega Genesis, but you had to get behind your stunned opponent to do this.
This was the Crush head vice. Basically, you have a downed opponent, and Crush, what he does is he places his hands on his opponent's head, and the ref calls for the bell.
Yes, he crushed his head.
Hey, as a kid, I totally bought it. I love this finish.
Do you remember his vignettes? Where it was like black and white, like childhood videos where he would crush cans and
pineapples.
That was his gimmick. He crushed stuff as a kid and grew up to be Crush.
I think this finish is awesome, man. It's like, can you imagine any more painful than permanent damage to a skull?
That is severely damaging. Potentially long-term. I always liked this guy the most because at this time when I was a kid, I always liked the Orange Crush pop.
Mm-hmm.
And now we had a wrestler named Crush.
Oh.
It was like, it was as if his name was Skittles. Who's I also like Skittles.
Who was your favorite rapper?
It was, why? Is there supposed to be a Crush rapper that I should be aware of?
You got Ice-T.
Oh, yes.
And Ice Cube.
Yeah, that's true. Lots of ice-themed rappers at the time.
Not much to this match.
4 minutes and 2 seconds.
Total filler.
I never remembered how many, like squashes there were on at this time.
Mm.
Okerlund then tees up the WWF title match, and we get a video package featuring Mr. Perfect choking Savage with a belt. Would have been fired in 2010. And there's a story of whose corner Perfect would be in. The two then tagged together on primetime wrestling, and the two came to blows, got a beat down by the Nasty Boys, Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect, and miscommunication as tag teams that are scheduled for a future singles match often find themselves in. And we go to Randy Savage against the Ultimate Warrior. It was a rematch from the prior year's WrestleMania career match between Savage and Warrior, which was one of the best matches the two had ever had in their career, especially for Ultimate Warrior. Not known for his match quality, but Randy Savage maybe pulling the best match ever out of the guy. Mm-hmm. Was trying to recapture magic here in London, England. And the two instituted the code of honor at the beginning of this match, and then got in each other's face when they shook hands. A very basic match at the start. They were starting very slow, as they would be out here for quite a while. And we saw Warrior get tossed to the floor, and Savage brings him back, hits an axe handle off the top. Warrior's offense at this time consisted of Irish whips, punches, a bear hug, a side slam, Savage getting a small package for a two count, and then Warrior would start working on the lower back of Savage and later selling his own neck as he went for a vertical suplex. And it was about halfway through the match way that Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect came down. I think they spent 8 minutes walking down the aisle, because this was a long aisle, as Way mentioned. And there's a double clothesline spot, as both are going for pinfalls. And then Mr. Perfect trips Randy. And Vince McMahon, this was the beginning of his legendary false announcements, where he would just, "Oh, he's with the Ultimate Warrior. Warrior has sold out. Why has the Warrior sold out?" And he would just go so far into these such conclusive findings. I mean, he was terrible. Just terrible at times. And there was a ref bump to Earl Hebner. My God, this man has not aged a day in 20 years. Whether he's getting bumped by Randy Savage or making out with Madison Rain, man looks the same.
Maybe he's just always looked old.
So Earl Hebner's knocked out, and Warrior climbs to the top rope and hits an axe handle, but Savage kicks out when Hebner comes back to consciousness. Savage then runs his knee into Warrior, and this takes out Hebner, and Savage hits a pile driver to Warrior, to which McMahon, with the referee out cold, McMahon states, "Macho Man retains the WWF Championship." Like, what a fool. What a fool. And this is when Perfect comes in, helps the Ultimate Warrior up, and holds him as Ric Flair lays out the Warrior with, they never use brass knucks. They always use these, like, white knucks. So, some foreign object.
They're taped with something.
To I guess, hide it. Because this white electric tape would hide it from his natural skin color. Anyway, so now no one knew who Mr. Perfect was trying to help, because he's attacked both men. But Warrior would power up, hit his clotheslines, a running shoulder block, press slam. But then he runs into the ropes, and Mr. Perfect goes to trip him, and he misses the trip, keeps running, and then on the other side, Flair hits him with a chair to the back. And this is when Savage gets up, and before he can go for the pinfall, he realizes someone has attacked the Warrior, and it must be the two men on the floor. And Savage climbs to the top rope, and he teases going for the elbow drop to Warrior, who's been laid out by the chair. But instead he turns and he jumps to the floor going after Ric Flair, and he was supposed to come into contact with Flair, and Flair would hit him in the knee with the chair, but the two really did not pull this one off spectacularly. But Savage is selling the knee, and he gets counted out, a count out finish way at 26 minutes and 13 seconds. That's how long this match went, a marathon by WWF title standards. And then Flair applied the figure four to Savage on the floor. Warrior makes the save, chases Flair and Perfect to the back with a chair, and then Warrior comes back, places the title onto the shoulder of Randy Savage and helps him, as Vince calls them two of the greatest of all time, but they'll never be in my Hall of Fame, goddammit. And I didn't really enjoy the first half of this match, but the last half really picked up, and by Ultimate Warrior standards, one of his better matches, and just kind of a shitty finish if you paid for this title match. a count out. I'm not a fan of a count out when you've invested so much time.
Yeah. I thought the crowd, again, was really amazing here. Even before the two touched, the superstar aura of both men was enough to light this crowd up. I thought, just as you did, for a warrior match, this was pretty good. But I thought all the bullshit surrounding the ring kind of took away from the flow of it. I wasn't very much into this Mr. Perfect mystery.
So there we go. They basically protected both baby faces. At this point, they had big plans for the Ultimate Warrior eventually, not knowing that they would have to fire this man in the fall. But that would not be the only baby face on this show who was featured prominently that would leave the company. So actually, Wei, this took place on a Saturday, and it was on the following Wednesday that Savage would drop the title to Ric Flair at the television tapings.
Okay. Interesting.
So Savage would only hold the title for a few more days. Okerlund is with Flair and Mr. Perfect. They discuss Plan A and then Plan B. And Flair says he should have had the title shot, and Okerlund is just outraged, saying that the title is coming back to him. That Flair says this, and Okerlund is just disgusted at the two. This is where they announced a crowd of 83,355, and then McMahon adds, "Oh, what a rush!" Harvey Whippleman is then in the ring, and I just watched a lot here, and I was like, wow, we still have two matches to go, and these are going to be lengthy matches. And Harvey Whippleman introduces Kamala from the dark continent of Africa.
Yeah.
The dark continent. Not the dark jungles of Africa, but the dark continent. It's a big continent.
Just as Europe is the white continent, and Asia is the yellow continent.
I guess so. I don't think they ever identify that.
No.
Not like that. The Undertaker, driven out on a hearse. The back of a hearse, Wei.
No, sure.
Who do you think was in that coffin?
Maybe money. Maybe $1 million.
Number three. Yeah. Key number three.
Yeah.
So the match begins here. Kamala, one of my favorite entrance themes. I always love that theme music.
It's great.
Just a basic jungle instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
They told Jim Johnson, Cannibal from the Dark Continent of Africa, come up with something by this afternoon. And they came up with a groaning...
Nailed it. Sounds like Africa.
That's a theme. That's their national anthem, actually.
Really? Wow.
Wow. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I heard it in the Olympics closing ceremony.
Yeah. So we start off here. Taker goes for... What would we call this move? Where he goes to the top rope and...
School.
School? This was... This was kindergarten.
Okay.
The kindergarten.
Sure.
And he hits Kamala with it. And then he goes for it again. And Harvey Whippleman shakes the top ropes. This is significant because, yes, The Undertaker did bump for Harvey Whippleman. He took a fucking somersault off the top rope to the mat. Undertaker bumping at this point.
Yeah.
He's not taking that spot today. Anyway, falls off. Kamala then clotheslines him to the floor. And Taker then grabs Whippleman and Kim Chi, but Kamala attacks him from behind. They go back into the ring, and Undertaker hits him with a choke slam, which at this point was called What a Move by Bobby Heenan.
Yeah.
And Undertaker goes for the tombstone, but Kim Chi runs in with his hat, hits him with his hat, his hat, for the disqualification at 3 minutes and 40 seconds. This was a little much for a pay-per-view.
They're
this pay-per-view hats. Cost $27.50 in 1992. And I'm sorry, we just got a count-out and a bump via hat. This was a big promoted match. This was second from the top.
No, it wasn't. Were people sold on this, Kamala versus Undertaker?
Kamala told a story on The Law years later that, and I don't know if this is true, but he said he saw the payout sheet. And Undertaker got $500,000 for this match, and Kamala did not get $500,000 for this match. I can't believe that figure.
Yeah, I can't believe it either.
I can't imagine that.
I can't either. To me, it just seemed like this was nothing but filler. It seemed like the two matches here were Brett versus Bulldog and Warrior versus Macho Man, and everything else in between was might as well have been Divas matches.
Well, there's a post-match attack here by Kamala. Splashes Undertaker, and then a top rope splash. And this was to build up to their eventual coffin match at Survivor Series 1992. But Taker sits up, and stalks Kamala to the back, with Kamala leaving in fear. And Heenan says, something is wrong with the Undertaker. He needs an autopsy. I would say if he needs an autopsy, something would definitely be wrong.
Oh, he's supposed to be dead.
He is dead.
So you get all...
Well, that's confirmation he's dead.
Right.
So, anyway. Sean Mooney then interviews the British Bulldog in front of a bulletin board. They had quite the backdrops here, Way. He says that this match has torn the family apart, but Jack Tunney made the match, and he's worked hard for this. Says that it's not pressure to go in front of 80,000 of my countrymen. It's my dream. Very good promo.
I thought this was a very good promo. I thought he had a great line when he said, when I step in the ring, Brett, I never met you. I don't even know you.
Very good. Then even better was Brett's promo with Okerlund, where he says, he brings up that line, I don't know you. He says, when the match starts and you don't know me, I'm the guy that introduced you to Diana. No one's helped you in your career more than me. And says it's that Bulldog's big dream will become a nightmare, and you're going to wake up in the dungeon of Windsor Castle. This is a real good heel promo from Brett.
This was as... I wouldn't even necessarily classify it as heel promo. It was just against his opponent.
I think Brett gets some undue knocks as a bad promo, because everyone talks about it. You know, it wasn't until 97 he became a really good promo, but this was a good promo.
This
was
as good as any promo he's ever done. This was the Bret Hart of my childhood watching this, and it put a total smile on my face.
I think people at times, when they think a good promo, they think of The Rock, they think of Chael Sonnen. But you know what? There's a lot of guys who I would find, you know, someone like, you know, a good babyface promo isn't going to be, you know, an entertaining catchphrase-filled promo. Sometimes you just want to hear a solid babyface give his reasons for why he's going to win.
Oh, I thought this was great.
I thought it was really good. So then we saw the Highlanders, not Rory and Robbie, but the actual Scottish Highlanders perform here on the bagpipes with Roddy Piper.
Mm-hmm.
This is weird. He had left the company after WrestleMania earlier that year and then made a cameo appearance here.
Hmm.
And then never came back.
Was he not on payroll even at this point?
I don't know. But he didn't wrestle another match till like 94 after this. Then we go to Sean Mooney at ringside with Diana Hart. And Diana talks about regretting that she might have been an obstacle in their path. And she worried about the two destroying each other, and she's not concerned with who wins. She loves them both, and the bond her family has is worth more than anything, including the Intercontinental title. What a contrast that is to today. We're comparing a family bond to putting that aside for the Intercontinental title. Could you imagine? I would never fight a family member for the Intercontinental title.
Today. No,
not today. Would. In 92, I'd consider it, but not today. I thought Diana, she was so nervous here that it made for a great interview.
She was not polished at all as a TV personality, but that
I thought it was
made
great.
It more believable. She sounded like a concerned athlete's wife.
Thanks very much, Sean. I'm very worried about them. She had like that heart accent.
Yeah, she did.
And Sean, unfortunately, I guess he was getting someone in his ear because he just like kept cutting her off. And just she's in mid-sentence. Okay, thanks a lot, Diana. We got to go back to you guys. He threw back to Finkel. So Bulldog comes out first. And who is carrying the Union Jack flag but
Canada's own Lennox Lewis, further betraying his country that trained
Lennox
him.
Lewis, a Canadian gold medalist. In the Olympics.
Yeah.
Carrying out the Bulldogs' Union Jack flag.
Against a Canadian.
Yes.
Bret the Hitman Hart.
What a turncoat. I'm surprised, you know, Lennox. He was hard to get a hold of as well. He can be someone tough to nail down for an interview
maybe
as well.
Maybe they ambushed him to do this.
Maybe. Oh, we're not going to do this now, are we? So Lennox Lewis, a young upstart, like Lennox Lewis was not really that big at this point, you know, European champion at this point. And then Brett comes out. Awesome aerial shot here of the entire stadium. Like, this felt like the biggest match in the history of wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
This was huge. and the air horns, as I mentioned. I think I have a soft spot for air horns. It just adds to such a big spectacle of a match.
You have a soft spot for air horns.
I like air horns in a match. They're nice. And very slow start here. They go into a series of roll-ups, and they were definitely pacing this to go for a long while. And we saw Bulldog catapult Hart into the turnbuckle and then attacks the left arm of Hart and gets cut off when Hart knees him in the gut. Get some booze here. Bulldog goes for a crucifix, but Hart just drops down. And Hart then, in my favorite spot, a pun spot in the match, delivered a Bulldog to Davey Boy Smith. And a few minutes later, Bulldog goes to the floor. And Hart here was like playing heel here to the crowd.
At
like
this point,
subtle heel tactics.
Yeah, he was great here. As the match progressed, obviously Bulldog was the favorite, but as the match progressed, the boos just kept getting louder for Brett. And he played it up. There's a fine line, I think, between playing a full-blown heel and somebody who, you know, who's supposed to come across as a babyface in enemy territory. And I think Brett straddled that line perfectly. I don't see a Hogan or a Warrior or many people of his many of his colleagues being able to do that as well as Brett.
There was I went back and read the Dave Meltzer's recap of this match from his 1992 Observer. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned the spot where Brett goes for the plancha to the floor and kind of overshoots Bulldog.
Yeah.
And at the time, Dave wrote how Bret Hart tried to execute a plancha and then hit a Bulldog in midair, a move that no one has ever attempted. Mm-hmm. And then later, Brett, years later, said how Bulldog was out of position and he almost fucked the whole spot up. And it was Brett just trying to salvage the move. And I guess Bulldog wasn't out far enough.
Yeah.
It looked fine. I mean, sometimes I think we get too much into the performance aspect and crisply executing moves.
Yeah.
And it's like part of it, like Chael Sonnen going for a spinning back fist and wiping out. I mean, I like watching sometimes stuff that does not look smooth.
Yeah.
And it's a fight.
That's what
you're trying to replicate at the end of the day. And I'm not as hard as, you know, maybe a spot is blowing, but it can still look good.
It's a fight. It's not a video game.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if a guy does a shooting star press and goes into the ropes, I get it. But,
although if Brett completely missed Bulldog, that would have been...
If he had overshot and gone into the front row, yeah, that would have been funny.
Yeah.
But this was fine. Vince McMahon, subtle as always, like just... had to work in this plug, I guess by contractual obligation, to Lennox Lewis will be fighting Razor Ruddock on October 31st.
And Heenan's like, he's fighting Razor Ramon?
Yeah. He would win that fight, folks. Spoiler alert. Then they went to all these cutaways to Diana, who they must have just told her, react to this like it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And for 25 minutes plus, she acted like the camera was on her for every second.
Yep.
Diana was awesome here.
She did a great job.
I was blown away here by how this felt so important.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like such a real fight and a real story.
Oh, yeah.
It added so much. Bulldog swung at Hart after he'd been selling, and Hart ducks and applies a sleeper, reaches the ropes, and this was Brett further playing the heel. He wouldn't let go at the count of five. So rather than getting DQ'd, the ref just would keep stop. He'd go, 4, 5. 1, 2, and he did this 3 times. He counted to 5, and Brett still wouldn't let go. Anyway, Bulldog, he goes for a military press and just, like, awkwardly drops Brett onto the ropes, and it's like Brett just, like, awkwardly falls.
It
and, like, I guess was trying to crotch himself and didn't.
Maybe.
Bulldog just didn't land him.
Maybe
there's
just too much momentum coming off in the press. I mean, this was, again, just like the plancha, it was one that you could consider to be a blunder of the match, but watching it in real life, like, it just looked like he landed awkwardly and made it, you know, more like a more punishing blow.
Yeah, and we'll let the interview with Brett, he speaks more to Davey Boy Smith and his performance in this match. Anyway, right after this awkward spot, Heenan had a great line. He said, looks like Diana Hart has a new sister.
Huh.
Anyway, we see a delayed vertical suplex delivered to Brett. Shades of Kenta Kobashi. Minus, like, 65 seconds.
Shades of Davey Boy Smith.
I guess. He did this move quite a lot.
He's just as known for it.
Bulldog goes
not
for
more.
Bulldog goes for his running power slam and gets a two count, and they play up how no one's ever kicked out of that. And it's weird, but you look back, I never associate Bulldog really with a finishing maneuver. I get, like, he would do the running power slam, but I never really thought of him as, like, having a finish. You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah?
I always associated this power slam with him.
Yeah. Anyway, Hart comes back with a bridging German, gets a two count, and then Bulldog hits a superplex off the top. The two then hit a double clothesline. Hart is on his back and applies the sharpshooter. Bulldog makes it to the ropes, and then this is the finish where Hart comes off the ropes from a Irish whip, goes for the sunset flip. Bulldog sits down, hooks the legs, and gets the pinfall out of nowhere at 25 minutes and 12 seconds.
I love that finish.
It was so good.
It's, you know, it's so simple. They don't need to stick to the formula of a finishing move and then a pinfall. Something as simple as sitting down on a sunset flip is simple. It's believable. It's a total surprise. And you allow the champion to retain his heat. The losing person to retain his heat. That plus the sharpshooter set up from the two of them laying down. Just absolutely brilliant. I thought this was great.
I love finishes where it's just completely out of nowhere, but the crowd totally reacts to it. It didn't feel weird. It was just great. A phenomenal match, phenomenal finish. And there's like this legend that came out of this match was that Vince told the guys who was going over, but he requested, I don't want to know how the match is going to finish. I want to be genuinely surprised calling the finish.
Cool. So that shows a huge amount of trust in the abilities of both men.
So a great match here to cap off. You know, it's two really, really good matches that for me carried the show for me. And I give this show an 8.5 out of 10, really based on two matches, because I can't really say a whole lot about the rest of the card. It didn't really do much. But those, especially the main event, it was just such a historical match. It was such a different mindset of the company to put these two on last, a phenomenal atmosphere, and that has to go into my grading.
Has there been another time where the IC title main evented over the main world title?
Jeez, I'm trying to think. Nothing comes to mind. I mean, they had obviously Hogan Warrior when Warrior was IC champ, but that was for the WWF title. But a singular IC title match, nothing comes to mind for a pay-per-view.
I felt that this main event was pretty much as perfect of a wrestling match as you could have. I mean, aside from a few missed spots here and there, but you know what? To the untrained eye, they wouldn't really be noticeable. Everything between the in-ring work, which was, great execution of maneuvers from both men, a well-booked match and a well-booked finish, and perhaps the best atmosphere you could possibly have here with the giant arena full of people that are incredibly hot for this hometown babyface, plus a good solid storyline behind what they're fighting for. I thought this was basically pro wrestling at its best.
I find that mid-90s Bret Hart character, I mean, I attribute a lot of that to why I stuck with pro wrestling, because I love that character and the matches. I think if you were such a big Bret Hart fan, you couldn't help but grow up for an appreciation for a well put together match, because it was so glaring when you would watch, you know, a Bret Hart main event, and it was a match that told a story and you got so emotionally invested into, and you could see a match that didn't have those elements and didn't get you the same way. And they always talk about Canadians having such an appreciation for work rate. That's kind of a byproduct of that stampede style.
Absolutely.
That carried over into the WWF at such a pivotal time for young audiences that grew up with that WWF product.
Absolutely. I give the show a 7 out of 10, pretty much almost exclusively for this main event alone. Overall, in terms of in-ring, this was not an amazing, amazing card. But the main event, plus, you know, a pretty solid semi-main event, and also the atmosphere of this crowd makes this a classic show.
All right. From here, let's head over to...
Brett?
Harry?
Oh, okay.
No, Brett.
Let's go to...
I thought you said Davey. I'm like, we don't have Davey.
No. Let's go to Brett.
Okay, we're going to hear from Bret Hart right now. This was when we did our marathon interview with Bret Hart back in 2010 for our Survival of the Hitman documentary, and chatting about this legendary match with the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith.
It was something very beautiful about that match in Wembley with Davey. because every spot, all the beginning, I always said it's like when you get two baby faces or two wrestlers, period, and you get them where they're nose to nose in the ring and they're getting ready to start, and you can actually look over at your friend and go, I don't know who's going to win. When you really don't know the outcome, that leaves it so open for some great, you can really have a movie. You can tell a great movie because they don't know what's going to happen. And that was what that gave me. I remember we had so many twists and turns. What I always remember at Wembley is the crowd. You can forget the match for a second. If you ever watch the crowd, just look at the crowd and you can see how every 82,000 wrestling fans that think every single move is real. And you don't get like they're watching the Super Bowl or they're watching Muhammad Ali fighting Mike Tyson. It was a beautiful moment in the match and everything. And I put that whole match together with great deliberation and time and patience and everything. And it was just such a magical moment. And when it was over, the night it was over, I thought I'd finally made my stamp on the wrestling. And to the wrestlers, that this might be the greatest match of all time, and that the film will never lie, and it still doesn't. It'll put me up there. You can put any match with Inoki and Shawn or an Undertaker or whatever match you can dig up anywhere, and I don't think it's better than the one with Wembley. When you look at the raw, what you have to deal with, and the reaction of the crowd, And so I was feeling pretty confident going into that year, 92. And when I lost the belt to Davey, I had a strong feeling that this was going to be I didn't think of myself as champion, but I thought I'll even go up higher in the card. I'll become a main eventer with Jake Roberts and some of those kind of guys where I get top billing I'll be a big star on the TV and stuff. Like, it'll all be upgraded up even higher. But I didn't think I'd be upgraded to champion. A lot of people thought it, and it's quite possible. I think I was one of the only guys that ever walked in and suggested to Vince the dropping of the title. I suggested to him to drop the belt at SummerSlam to Davey. And I told him that it was going to be the greatest match of all time. And they believed me. And I think I came pretty close to delivering that to him, because I think deep down inside, Vince McMahon is the biggest wrestling fan in the world. And when he watched me and Wembley with Davey, I think he saw wrestling as an art form, like that I was an artist that had the ability to be very dramatic.
Thank you very much to Bret Hart for joining us here on Review Away, reminiscing about a match that he calls his greatest ever. From Wembley Stadium in 1992, obviously a well-remembered match, to say the least, and maybe when the Intercontinental title was at its most prestigious, you could argue.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was a time, Ultimate Warrior, it was always a big title, and Bret and Bulldog headlining this show, I think it told people that this title is so important, and it never felt like it was just an afterthought, which... Mm-hmm. I don't even think it's a thought period right now with The Miz.
No, unfortunately.
Another person who was there live at Wembley Stadium as a spectator, though, was a 6-year-old Harry Smith. And that's who we go to next, who watched this show featuring his father and uncle headlining the show. All right, we are joined right now by former WWE performer and now soon to be returning to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and he's also going to be in our neck of the woods performing Friday in Ottawa and then Sunday in Barrie, Ontario. We'll get into those shows later. But Harry Smith returning here to The Law. How are you doing today, Harry?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, thanks. How are you guys doing?
We are doing well, and we just got some late-breaking news that you will be returning to New Japan Pro Wrestling in September.
Yeah, that's right. They told me to keep it as a secret, so I did the best on my end, too. And then I guess that they had just announced it, so that's fine with me. Don't need to keep it a secret anymore.
it's the speed of the internet, Harry. It's spreading like wildfire already, so big news.
Yeah, spreading like wildfire, like a forest fire, right? Yeah.
Well, New Japan,
should be great.
They just finished their G1 Climax tournament over the weekend, and they announced a few people returning, including Kazushi Sakuraba, and that's got to be kind of cool for you that maybe there's a chance on a future tour to get to work with Sakuraba.
Oh, hell yeah. You know what? See, that is, that's all news to me because I didn't even, and just out of curiosity, who did win, the G1? Cause I didn't follow it that much.
They had Okada win. He defeated Carl Anderson in the final. Yeah. Have you got to follow any of Okada earlier this year? I mean, he had the run with the IWGP title, and I think kind of like a breakthrough performer this year for New Japan.
Yeah, I watched. I saw his one of his title matches with Tanahashi, and I thought that he's really good and a world of potential, and he's still pretty young, right? Like 24.
Yeah, young guy.
So, he's going to be. I think he's going to be. He's already great. He's going to be. Future, he's going to be the future of that company for sure. So hopefully I get a chance to work with him. And yeah, Sakuraba, absolutely. I mean, that's dude's one of my idols. And, I trained under Billy Robinson and he's, his first teacher was Billy Robinson too. So that'll be, definitely pretty cool to work with, Kazushi Sakuraba and, my love for catch wrestling. I would, hopefully be able to roll around from that, on the mat before shows if time could prevent that. And, be able to ask him questions, probably hound him, but that would be and then of course be able to pro wrestle with him would be awesome too.
At this point right now, Harry, who or where exactly are you training a lot during the week, doing jiu-jitsu and just rolling around and stuff like that? Are you in Tampa right now?
Yes, I am in Tampa. We are I train during the week here at Dave Bautista's school. And then, I was going to try to plan a trip out to Los Angeles, this month to see, Josh Barnett and train with some guys out there. But, I may just stay in Tampa and do the fight camp with Bautista. He's getting ready for his fight, coming up on October 6th. So, I do, do most of my training here in Tampa. And then I go, when I go to Calgary, there's, a place where Nick Ring trains at, Champions Creed Martial Arts, great school, one of the best actually, in the world that I've been to. And I go to Los Angeles for train with Josh Barnett and Ken Yasuda out there and Higgin Machado. And then I go to also Little Rock, Arkansas, where Billy Robinson trains. And so I try to keep my, if I can use my frequent flyers, I'll go, okay, I'm going to fly here for this week. Or, if I'm on the West Coast, okay, I'm going to stay a week and train with Josh and these guys. So I try to keep my training, switch it up every week, train with as many different people and great people as I can to become better. So, but a lot of it's in Tampa, that's where I live here. So
now I don't know if you got to see the recent UFC card in Calgary, but the main card.
Yeah, I was there live. Yeah.
Oh, you were at the event then. Well, that was fantastic because I think one of the stellar moments on the main card, and believe me, there weren't many, was right after that Czech Congo Sean Jordan fight. The crowd was less than impressed, I think, with the effort, and then it was an immediate cut to Brett at Octagon side and instantly turning the crowd around. I thought it was a brilliant call by the director, and tell us just a bit about the actual Calgary card being there live, because the undercard I thought was fantastic on that show.
Yeah, I thought that the undercard was really good too. It was a big problem because it was a card based on a bunch of it was a screw up card basically. Everybody and their everybody, there was how many injuries and guys having to back out due to injuries or things with the commission and stuff like that. So it was a card based on, definitely a scratch and erase kind of card. You know what I mean? So, I thought that, I did like the Faber-Burrell fight. I actually did. And a lot of people, in the crowd, I think that they were just had enough. And I think that they were wanting to see more action and, like the Tim Bosch and
Hector Lombard
fight there. Lombard, I thought that there was for sure going to be a knockout in the first or second round. And, I don't know if it was everyone was playing too defensively or just, it's just sometimes cards happen that way. And I think that it being the first time in Calgary, the things that the fans were expecting, everybody getting knocked out, great finishes and, just was you know, a lot of, some of the fights were good technically. I personally enjoyed it just being there, but I understand, you know, the crowd was pissed off and Dana was mad at the crowd, you know, saying that, you know, he didn't know what they were watching, but, you know, the Sabre-Brow fight was amazing, and it was. And so, you know, I enjoyed it personally, but, you know, I understand fans are pissed and this and that. But, hey, also, you know, a lot of injuries happened. Card got switched around so many times, and, you know, I don't know what if it was something in the air that night, but, you know, why there weren't, you know, knockouts and stuff like that, I can't tell you, if you know. But I enjoyed it myself, but that's the way it goes sometimes. It's mixed martial arts, right?
And we also we saw your uncle, Brett, escort Nick Ring down to the octagon. How did Brett enjoy the event?
Yeah, he did. He actually asked me if I wanted to walk him down. I said, sure, you know, because I used to train with Nick when I lived in Calgary. And then commission said there's just too many people. They only wanted, like, one person. I said, no, that's fine. And, you know, Brett, I think he enjoyed it a lot. I didn't get a chance to speak to him much after, but, you know, he had a good time, I think. He was there with his wife, Stephanie, so, and got to support the Calgary homeboy, Nick Ring. And Nick, you know, won by decision, did pretty good. So kudos to him, and hopefully he gets another fight in UFC too.
We are chatting here with Harry Smith. He's going to be in Ottawa, Ontario this Friday for the Fighting Back Wrestling with Cancer benefit show to raise money for the Canadian Cancer Society. And then Sunday, he'll be in Barrie, Ontario for 3A Wrestling. And Harry, on this show as well, myself here and Wei, we were looking back at the 1992 SummerSlam event. It's amazing. It's been 20 years since this event, but one that obviously maybe the highest profile match in your father's career with Uncle Brett, and you were there live for that show at Wembley Stadium.
That's right. Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, 80 some odd thousand, you know, people, and you know, I think I told the story before, but you know, it was so exciting being there. But we were in the what was called the Royal Seats, which was, you know, way up in the almost like the nosebleed section, but that's where the Queen sits to watch the events and stuff like that. And but you know, unfortunately, that high up, we couldn't even, and it was kind of a bad angle with the screen and stuff like that. But I could hear the energy from the crowd, and I could see kind of like, you know, two small guys in the ring from being that high, like two ants wrestling. And I kept watching and trying to, you know, oh, did he, you know, was there a three count? And then when I finally heard the bell ring and the three count happened, I didn't know who had won, because there were so many Bret Hart fans there, you know, as well. He was huge, you know, major popular over there. So I had to wait for, you know, the official decision from Howard Finkel that, you know, my dad had won. And as soon as I heard that, it was just amazing. I mean, the ambience, the atmosphere, the crowd, I couldn't even hear myself think. It was so loud there. And it was a really great moment for my dad, probably his finest moment in pro wrestling. And, you know, 20 years later, you know, SummerSlam again. I don't know what's going on this year, but don't really care either. But
I'll tell you one thing. I don't think The Miz as Intercontinental Champion will be going on last in front of 80,000 people. I'm pretty sure that's happening.
But, you know, I actually want to give props to the SummerSlam 2002 event, which is actually one of my favorite events also. But, you know, Rey Mysterio and Kurt Angle kicked it off. I think RVD and, well, Chris Benoit, I think they were on that, God rest his soul. You know, Triple H and Shawn Michaels had a fantastic match that night. You know, it was actually top to bottom one of the WWE's best put together cards ever. So kudos to SummerSlam 2002, one of my favorite events.
Now, at the time of this SummerSlam 92, Harry, how old were you?
I would have been six, yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, your mom was very much involved in the match as well, both in the angle and as well as sitting at ringside. So I was just curious, who were you sitting with up in there in the royal seats?
I was sitting up there my mom, she was sitting, like, down in the crowd somewhere, and then they led her down to the ring. I was watching it, I was up there with me, my sister, my grandfather, my Aunt Tracy, who's passed away, my Aunt Joanne, Uncle Terrence, Walter O'Malley, my dad's trainer. I think, no, Ted Bentley wouldn't have been there. No, yeah, so it would have been
would have been just them, immediate family and stuff like that.
So at 6 years old, how privy were you to the inner workings of professional wrestling?
I knew a little bit about it, but everything was still kept pretty kayfabe to me, honestly. I knew some things, but there was a lot of it was business was highly protected in those days. I mean, it's different nowadays with things, but
And so did you
no,
actually
it was very highly protected, and a lot of kayfabe was really strong then. So
and did you actually think there was any real dissent between your father and your uncle?
Well, actually, for that event, kind of, because the promos and stuff like that leading up to it, and then I think we'd come up there that summer to film some promos and stuff like that in Calgary, and then it was led to believe that there was animosity and stuff like that. My mom would kind of say this to me or that to me, so they kayfabed, not all the way, but there was going to be competitive, and they might actually hit each other in there a few times, and I was led to believe that. I was sure that it was obviously a physical match. I saw Brett give a pretty good stop right in the face at one point in the match. Felt too good, but it was obviously a very physical matchup. So it was like I said, things were kept pretty kayfabe back then and pretty protected. So
years later, I'm sure you and your father maybe chatted a bit about the match. I was just curious some of his reflections on it, because Brett holds that match as perhaps his greatest match he ever had.
He certainly said that. He held it as his finest moment and everything like that. As far as the match itself, I never really asked him much about it. We would watch it, friends were over or something and they'd want to see it, through kind of a historic match, right? So but he never we never talked much about it. I asked him for whatever reason it wasn't discussed, but I asked him a lot of stuff about wrestling guys like the Cobra and the Malenko brothers and Shawn Michaels and
Do you remember the immediate reaction of, the people you were with, your grandfather, for instance, to the match? I mean, obviously, you mentioned you had a tough time seeing it, but I was curious about Stu's reaction to seeing, two of his products wrestle in front of such a huge crowd.
He was very ecstatic, It was like, we were all jumping for joy up there. It was quite a, incredible, event and everything. And hearing him win and, being able to watch it afterwards was awesome too, to actually see the match itself. Everyone's reaction was, everybody went bananas pretty good and, huge celebration.
Yeah, I just can't fathom. I mean, you're at such a young age, and I'm like sure you're used to seeing your father on television and featured prominently, but it's just like a completely different world here at that Wembley Stadium. They're completely full to see your father here as the national hero here, winning the title. I mean, that has to be something that just even at that young age has to just be an imprint in your memory.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, a tattoo on the memory. Yeah.
Now, how about it was 2010? You got to work SummerSlam alongside Tyson, correct?
No, I was never good enough for SummerSlam. Apparently, I think we were the only titles that weren't defended that night. I think Brett came back he was in that six man or eight man or whatever.
That's
Texas.
Right.
And Daniel Bryan came back. Yeah. But we defended them at Fan Access or whatever the thing is called, against Straight Edge Society. And we actually, for the little amount of fans there, we we still put on a pretty good show for them. But no, we weren't. I was never on a SummerSlam.
How much time did you and your family spend in the UK? Because obviously your father was very much a national figure, but you, having grown up in Canada, did you feel any of that, adopting any of that support when in the times that you did wrestle out there?
I spent a little bit of time over in England. It was mostly just trips over there. And then I spent a bit of time over there wrestling, for 1PW and IPW, and then I went over there for Brian Dixon's All-Star Wrestling right before I got signed with WWE, and then I cut that All-Star trip short to, you know, come back to Canada and start on, you know, on the road with WWE. So I started, you know, I did a little bit, but I have a UK passport and everything like that. I'd love to go back and do some shows and see some family, but I don't know if the economy's down there or what. I haven't heard much wrestling-wise coming from the UK at all, really. So
I don't know if you're aware of this trivia note, Harry, but another future wrestler also attended that show. A very young Nigel McGuinness, dressed up as the Ultimate Warrior, attended that show.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yes.
I didn't know that.
I think he was like 8 years old, and he talked about, had the face on for Warrior, and was, he said that was the day he chose to be a professional wrestler. So two future prominent wrestlers are taking in the show at a very young age is our interesting trivia note.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Who were some of your other favorites at the time as a young six-year-old? I mean, obviously outside of your uncles and your father.
Oh, shoot, as a six-year-old, well, I loved Hulk Hogan. Well, I still enjoy, you know, watching No Holds Barred and stuff like that. And
yes, remastered now on DVD.
I'm sure at a young age there, you know, I still like my Uncle Brett and, you know, of course my dad. I remember... Yeah, I liked the Legion of Doom. I liked, when I was young, six, I liked Roddy Piper, but prior to that, when I was about, I think three or four, Roddy Piper was like my all-time favorite wrestler. And then, when you kind of went on the commentating, you know, it kind of faded. I loved Roddy Piper.
Well, Harry, I want to thank you very much for joining us once again. He's going to be in Ottawa this Friday. It's the Fighting Back Wrestling with Cancer Benefit Show taking place at 3750 North Beauville Road in Ottawa, Ontario. You can go to fighting-back.ca for more information. And then 3A Wrestling this Sunday at the ANAF Club at 7 George Street in Barrie, Ontario. You can go to 3awrestling.com for more on that. And then New Japan Pro Wrestling coming up in September. So anything else you would like to plug here, Harry?
Yeah, well, you know, I believe I'm wrestling Bobby Lashley on both of those events, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I did two shows with him, in Okinawan Federation shows last year, and got to know Bobby a bit and got a lot of respect for him, and I think that we're going to put on a great show for the fans, and especially on the 17th, the cause for curing cancer is going to be great, and I think that the fans can expect a pretty intense matchup with Bobby Lashley and myself. I'm going to be trying to throw submissions at him. He's going to use his power, and I think that it's going to be a really great match, great event. Definitely looking forward to going back to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and it looks like I'm going to be a part of the Suzuki Gun Army. And, I always kind of hold New Japan as kind of home sweet home. You know, I went there 6-7 years ago. I trained with Tokyo Joe up in Calgary and went there with Tyson Kidd and formed friendships over there with guys like Tenzan, Nagata, Jushin Thunder Liger, and some of these guys that wrestled people like my Uncle Owen and others. So, I think that I hope that New Japan is going to be kind of my home now. So, I've been watching a lot of it lately, guys like coming up like Okada, and I've wrestled Tanahashi before. Hopefully I get a chance to do that again, and they got a lot of great talent, great new stars and stuff like that. So I think that New Japan's coming up pretty good, and I hope to make it my new home base and have some really great matches over there and great memories and make some history happen. So thanks for having me on the show also, guys, and looking forward to the shows this weekend.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate it very much, Harry. Think you're going to fit in really well with New Japan. The company's got a ton of momentum right now, and just looking ahead to this weekend, Harry, I mean, if Dave Bautista looks good against Rashid Evans, I think every MMA promoter is going to be trying to put together Bautista and Bobby Lashley, so you might come between enemy lines here for a future MMA fight.
Yeah, that could happen, but I think that would be a great fight, too, if it were to happen, so but we'll see.
All right, that was Harry Smith. So if you're in the Ontario area, whether it be Ottawa or Barrie, he will be there this weekend. And if you're in Japan, Chris Charlton, WH Park, maybe they'll go see Harry September the 7th for New Japan Pro Wrestling. I am very stoked to see Harry go into New Japan right now, where I think it's a style that really works to his advantage. And I don't know if he's going to go the MMA route, to be honest. Like, I don't know if it's worth it for him.
Yeah.
If you can get consistent dates in Japan and work year-round versus, what, like a couple fights a year on small-level MMA shows?
But outside of what you can make, an athlete always wants to challenge and test his skills. So, yeah, you know, we'll have to see. It can't hurt his pro wrestling credibility, I don't think.
I like when we get to break news, though, to wrestlers.
Yes.
Got to do a bit of it there with Harry.
Yeah. I think he learned just as much from talking to us as we did from him.
So at this point, we are going to go to our third guest, you, the audience. You didn't know where I was going there, did you, Wei?
Very nice.
All right. Let's chat SummerSlam 1992. You know, we always talk, Wei, about how, you know, you sometimes view events in light with, like, rose-colored glasses, and nostalgia can always increase people's memories of a show. I think this is one that, you know, a very good event in and of itself, and I think time only adds to that. This is a very highly regarded event in people's memory.
This was a show that you guys requested, the most votes that we've ever had out of all the ones that we've done so far. So let's see what you guys have to say, and we'll start with Michael Bryant, who says, "Finally, you guys review this pay-per-view. I think I speak for most listeners when I say that this review is highly anticipated. Anyway, getting to the show itself, the opening tag match was an awesome, fast-paced match and a great way to start off the show hot. The Virgil versus Nails matchup was one of the low points of the show, as they managed to make a 4-minute match drag. I already count him in my top 10 worst gimmicks ever. Michaels versus Rick Martel was good for what it was, and it's amazing how Sean can work a good match despite a crappy stipulation. The Natural Disasters match was good, Crush versus Smash was terrible, and Taker and Kamala was painful to watch after seeing such classics with The Undertaker in the past couple years. The atmosphere for the Savage Warrior match was crazy, with 80,000 in Wembley erupting. A Flair and Perfect interference was well done, and these two managed to have a great match, albeit I still prefer their Mania one better. Still one of Warrior's strongest performances, and Macho Man made him look like $1 million. And finally, the main event between Bret and Bulldog was extremely memorable, and what I considered to be one of the greatest matches of all time. The whole family drama was great and made for an emotional ending, and Bulldog finally got one of the biggest pops of all time. All in all, tremendous match by these two, and one I can watch over and over without getting bored. Overall, the crowd was fantastic all night, and the moment created in the end has gone down in history as one of the greatest WWE moments of all time. That alone makes me disregard all the crappy filler. With that said, I give this pay-per-view a 7.5 out of 10.
All right, we go on to Zach Volk. As much as this event stands out to me due to the cool-looking venue and the great IC main event, what is more noteworthy is this being the midpoint for the huge turnover in talent. The 92 Rumble features, in my mind, the strongest roster of all time in the WWF. By the end of 92, the roster is close to its weakest ever. They said they showed one of the greatest matches in WWF history with Bret and the Bulldog. From both a work rate and storytelling standpoint, this match is an example of why we are wrestling fans. They didn't need crazy high spots or any outlandish run-ins. It was a pure wrestling match with a compelling storyline. The undercard and other main event were of a much lower quality. Warrior Savage was garbage compared to their match from Mania 7, but at the time, WWF did a good job building the angle and making you wonder if Warrior or Savage were working with Flair and Perfect. Unfortunately, the match was a clusterfuck. Speaking of clusterfucks, that's what we ended up getting from the Michaels-Martel match due to the involvement from Sherry. What could have been a really entertaining and well-worked heel-versus-heel match was too overbooked, in my opinion. As far as I can remember, this was the first heel-versus-heel match on a WWF pay-per-view. Am I wrong? The rest of the card was whatever, but boy did the atmosphere from Wembley Arena elevate the proceedings. A 7 out of 10. Do you guys know anything as to why so much talent left during the year? Was it a coincidence? Was WWE needing to save money due to Vince's legal issues, or what? I think drug testing had a huge impact on that when it was instituted during that same year. In terms of heel versus heel, nothing comes to mind. I'm sure there might have been, but I can't think of any pre 92. It's obviously I mean, face versus face to me is more of a draw than heel versus heel. I just find two heels is like death.
Hmm. Jamie from the UK says, I actually attended this event at Wembley Stadium when I was 16 years old at the time. I remember being so excited and thrilled to get tickets as they were like gold dust. The UK wrestling fans are very loyal and lap up any WWE or TNA live action we can get. We had fairly decent seats and the stadium was a sellout. My lasting memory is obviously Davey beating Bret for the IC title, and after reading Bret's book where he talks about the build-up and the state that Davey Boy was in before the match, it makes the two performances, mainly Bret's, even that more impressive. Oh, we forget to mention that apparently Davey Boy was received a legit staph infection just days before the event.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
not know that.
Absolutely makes it more impressive. Looking back now, the rest of the show was average to good, to be honest. And yes, I'm too lazy to watch it again. Us Brits are lazy sometimes. But at the same time, it was a great spectacle. I'll try and upload a picture of the ticket as I have it somewhere. Overall, from memory alone, a 7.25 out of 10.
7.25. All right, we go to Rob Tonkinson. Wow, how 90s and embarrassing us Brits look back then when watching in hindsight. The thumbs down to all the heels was so Gladiators crowd, like I was waiting for Another One Bites the Dust to start playing after every match. I loved how Heenan said when the Bank of England needs a bailout, it goes to Ted DiBiase. That's where we went wrong in the credit crunch. We didn't contact the Million Dollar Man. The show itself looked like a spectacle and proves to me at least why WWE have to get out of the Big Four. Get one of the Big Four over in the UK at least once every two or three years. It's a shame they didn't have this year's SummerSlam in London, but with the Olympics and the start of the football soccer season, that would never happen. Obviously, the main event is the memorable point of this show. I had to laugh at the young fan before the show saying, Bulldog's going to win, whether he wants to or not. That kid would make a great negotiator, even with his accent flip-flopping between Northern English and Southern American. It was a great match between two very good workers, and the pop at the end was deafening, to say the least. This match also showed how much the IC title used to mean something, that it could actually headline pay-per-views ahead of the WWF champion. Obviously helped by Davey Boy being in the main event, but still people were into it and weren't disappointed that it wasn't Davey Boy versus the world champion or even the world championship match as the main event. I'd be doubtful even a Wade Barrett versus IC champion match would garner that much interest 20 years later if SummerSlam 2012 was at the new Wembley Stadium.
I cannot see that getting any interest. Wade Barrett versus Santino. Can it headline Wembley Stadium?
Ooh.
New Wembley Stadium.
Well, maybe. Maybe if they were secretly brother-in-laws.
Okay.
Wade Morella.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Greg Taylor. Three things always strike me when I think about this card from 20 years ago. First, Paul Bearer slapping the mat as a signal for Undertaker to sit up after Kamala's post-match beatdown. Number two, this was the official death of the Road Warriors. In 4 years, they went from taking a huge metal spike to and bloodying Dusty Rhodes' eye and laying waste to Sting, granted they're not alone here, to curtain jerking with a puppet. In their heyday, when you heard their original Iron Man entrance theme, it was like seeing Bruiser Brody make his entrance. You knew some shit was going to go down, but you didn't know that. Those were the good days. Three, the IC title match. Bret has taken most of the credit for this match, but Davey more than held his own. It was memorable watching the immediate post-match reactions. Wembley popped huge, and Bret sold his loss like a guy who made a really dumb chess move to lose the mother of all chess matches, beaten fairly but not dominated.
We go to Andrew Sheehy, who I think more than anyone else wants to see us review this show. Thank you for deciding to review this show. This time period for the WWF was unique as the company was in transition to the new generation era. This show is proof of it. The opening tag match between LOD and Money Inc. was solid. Seeing Hawk get through a match while out of it was crazy. Nails and Virgil was a match that should have been a dark match instead of a pay-per-view. The Martel Michaels match was pretty entertaining, with Sensational Sherry's outfit being the most entertaining thing about it. Undertaker's entrance on a hearse before his mediocre match with Kamala was great. That entrance probably contributed to the biggest pay disparity between two opponents in the history of pro wrestling. The tag title match between the Natural Disasters and Beverly Brothers was fine. However, the big draw for this show was the co-main events. The WWF title match with the Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage was great, just like their WrestleMania 7 match from the year before, and Flair and Perfect playing a big role in the countout finish. It helped set up a title change at the next TV tapings with Flair regaining the belt. Finally, the IC title match between Bulldog and Brett was a 5-star classic. The storytelling and psychology, along with family tension and a hot crowd, made this match one of the greatest in WWF/E history, with Bulldog going over and a huge pop from the UK crowd. This match showed the world that Brett was ready to become a main eventer, and he became World Wrestling Federation champion 6 weeks after this show. Great show, thanks to a great crowd at Wembley Stadium. 9.5 out of 10.
From Mr. B. Campbell. Sensational choice this week, guys. Heenan's ruby red sparkling tux was awesome. Is it just me, or did DiBiase look like a hometown jobber in those white trunks? I never understood this ending. They break up the Doomsday device only to have Animal win 5 seconds later with a power slam. Well, nobody wanted to take that move, apparently. Flair kept wiping his mouth during his first promo, which freaked me out, but not as much as the fact that Virgil got a pay-per-view promo when he says he's too legit to quit. And Nails gets no entrance, and maybe the worst pay-per-view match I've ever seen. Interesting booking to have a 30-minute title match end by countout. Great main event in Hart versus Bulldog, a true classic. Can you imagine this focus on the IC title nowadays? A 5 out of 10.
Next up, fantastic show. Davey Boy is probably my favorite wrestler, although there isn't any real good reason for that. I was just a wicked Bulldog mark since childhood. And this is, as far as I know, his best match, at least televised worldwide. I've read that Brett carries on about him blowing up in the first 5 minutes and carried the whole thing on his own, which, even if it is true, there's no reason for him to say it. Warrior should have turned heel. Virgil can go and hang. That's my thoughts. Awesome podcast. I burn through tons of iPhone battery each week on it. Maybe a review of the WWF Madison Square Garden show from 84 where Hogan wins the title could be in order.
From Corey Ferreira. One of the best SummerSlams ever. This show is all about the main event of Bulldog and Brett. The IC title has never meant that so much than it did going into this show. This is the best match Bulldog would ever have, and that is debatable for Bret Hart. Also, a match I find underrated is the Warrior vs. Savage title match. It's not to the level of their match a year and a half earlier from WrestleMania 7, but it's still a very good match. If I recall, they were going to do Flair vs. Savage in a rematch from WrestleMania 8, but decided not to because of Flair in his case of vertigo. Lastly, I was recently reading a copy of the old Wrestling Observers from this time frame, and they give some great info into the goings-on in the WWF around this time with all the steroid stuff and the fall in WWF business at the time.
Next up, we've got James Starkey. How many times did Vince say over 80,000 fans during this? Probably over 80,000 times. This event is pretty special to me. I didn't have the means to watch WWF television back then, so I had to rely on VHS recordings people gave to me. And being a young English boy, the event was a bit special. I watched it back a few days ago, and I had forgotten about all the corny angles that I ate up as a kid. The LOD entrance, the Natural Disasters, Kamala, and the comments by Heenan after he was disqualified and the officials were ringing the bell. Kamala is going to think that's the dinner bell. And of course, the main event, which was spectacular. I loved it 20 years ago when I was 7 years old, and I love it now. Brilliant. Vince's constant 1, 2, 3, no, was annoying as usual, and I expect a Joe Poe impression during the review. But the best part of his commentary has to be when Tatanka was in the ring. I'm not so sure these 80,000 fans in England have ever seen a Native American before. Oh, well, that must have been some special edition with Tatanka's dark match on it.
From Peter from Denmark, our final commenter on this show. This show is super special for me as I attended it live with my dad and got to travel by ferry to London, England. I was 12 at the time and it was mind-blowing being among so many other WWF fans of various nationalities, and Wembley practically exploded when Howard Finkel walked to the ring, which I remember was pretty puzzling to my dad. They pulled out all the stops for the entrances with LOD on Harleys, Undertaker in a hearse, and Lennox Lewis with Davey Boy, but even at the time I thought the in-ring was lacking, except Shawn versus Martel, Savage Warrior, and the main event. I was bummed that I didn't get to see Hulk Hogan, though he mentions in the song Hulkster in Heaven that he wrestled there.
Oh, yeah, this was the infamous SummerSlam where he claimed he had gone over and met with a kid that would later pass away. And yeah,
he's, what? A whole song about this?
He wrote a song about some kid that he met at SummerSlam 1992 in London, England, when he was not with the company anymore.
Okay.
This was in his first book, which was just scattered full of Hulk Hogan stories.
Since it was the first pay-per-view the WWF ever did without him. That, however, makes it all the more significant, and I remember the whole stadium being ecstatic that Hart-Bulldog match went on last, which for Bret Hart signaled many headlining pay-per-views to come, and for Bulldog, not so much.
All right, so that is all of our feedback. Thanks to all of you for posting here in the Law Message Board. And that is going to bring us to a close for this week's show. I want to thank Bret Hart and Harry Smith for joining us. Always great chatting with Harry and Bret. And next week, Way, we are going to look ahead, and we are going to be joined by an old friend. And I promise not to get sick this time.
Oh, yes. Damian Abraham from Fucked Up is going to show up, and you are going to show up too, aren't you, John?
I am going to be here, I promise, next time. I missed our Damian show the last time, so I will make sure to be here next week. And Damian has, I gave him the selection, and he is going with one of the FMW releases from about a decade ago.
The American FMW DVDs.
Yeah, voiced by Ken Watanabe and some Canadian guy. This one we are going to be reviewing, Yokohama Deathmatch.
Yokohama Deathmatch, yes. Maybe we will have that other Canadian guy on the show as well.
We might have to. So that is going to be coming up next week here on the program. In the meantime, you can always check out liveaudiowrestling.com, lawradio.proboards.com. And for those that are on our message board, I am in the process of fixing our archives. I was ecstatic because I was thinking to myself, "Way, man, what am I going to do with my week? I have nothing to do all week." For you, the folks.
Yeah.
But I'm not complaining.
Enjoy yourself.
I will. So, Way, on our way out here, you have got the theme song to or music musical selection, and of course, you can give Way a follow at WAI0937 at Law Radio. And Way, what would you like to hear to cap off the 92 SummerSlam recap?
Well, as much as I would love to hear the Hulkster's account of SummerSlam 1992, I'd prefer to go out on maybe a more interesting note. Let's go to the number one hit in the UK of August of 1992, Snap, Rhythm is a Dancer.
Oh, a classic.
Knew you'd like that.